Are you ready for some comic book talk? It's me, Dave, with the AIPT Comics Podcast, and I am your co-host. There are two other co-hosts. We have Forrest Hollingsworth.
Forrest with two R's, brother.
And Connor Christensen.
Connor Christensen, linebacker, University of Nevada.
And we're here to talk about last week's comics and the comics coming up, but also some other topical things like news and some things that are trending. We always start with the news here, and starting with our news is Kickstarter came out with some statistics on the comics that were Kickstarted in 2018, and surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, the numbers were quite good. They're actually up 26%.
Or 26% over 2017.
It's only going up, and I mean, it makes sense, because, you know, a lot of the things on Kickstarter, you kind of have to have a campaign that's doable, and a comic, relatively speaking, is probably easier to make than a new invented refrigerator that freezes via gel or something.
That sounds so awesome in the grossest way.
I don't know if that is on Kickstarter if it ever was, but if it was, I imagine it'd be much harder to pull that off and invent that than a comic book. So
I think it's rad that comic books are doing so well on Kickstarter, because you know how hard it can be to get a pitch recognized by Image or Boom or IDW, whoever, because we know Marvel and DC don't accept pitches anymore. So it's cool that Kickstarter's a different outlet for people to get noticed and for people to get their work out there. And I think having a Kickstarter is more visible than a webcomic, because I think webcomics get overlooked a lot. And I think a Kickstarter is just like, I don't know, it's more valuable and it's more tangible.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the exact word I was going to use. Yeah. And it's not an insignificant amount of money. You know, a percentage is a percentage, but we're looking at upwards of $16 million, which in terms of actualizing comic book work is not insignificant. So I think that that's pretty impressive. And I think that it can go a long way in helping bring a lot of interesting art and a lot of interesting untold stories from a broad group of creators into the marketplace. So I don't think that that can hurt the storytelling medium in any way. I also think it makes sense that these new hobby avenues are finding funding on Kickstarter, because we have seen, I think, and I'm sure someone is going to at me and tell me I'm wrong, but over the last couple of years, video game funding has gone down.
Mm-hmm. There's been some campaigns that kind of never got off the ground, right?
Yeah, and there's some that just, like, don't meet the things that they're promising.
Right.
There's some that just completely fail, even after being fully funded. And so you've seen board games and comics go up year over year. And that makes sense, because the people that are interested in video games are also interested in board games and presumably comics. I mean, I certainly am. And so to put money into things that are tangible and still ancillary to the things that you're interested in totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, so 1,457 comic book projects were funded in 2018. And there's some folks that actually we've interviewed at AIPTcomics.com, like Pat Shand, who seems to have moved into this realm where he's obviously still doing work with like Marvel or Xenoscope, but he's also doing these campaigns to sort of fund and get revenue in the year. It's obviously viable. What fascinates me is when companies like Top Cow and IDW are pushing books on Kickstarter, instead of just publishing it themselves, they're sort of trying to get this extra dough before it actually comes out in trade paperback or even in single issues.
I think it's probably just a way to gauge interest. I think that that's maybe unfortunate, or I would feel a little bit
cheated.
Yeah, cheated. If I were the creator, that's a good word for it. If I brought a project to Image or Top Cow or any of the imprints that the independent publishers have, and they did that. But it's a sensible way, and it's a good way to gauge the market and a way to gauge interest from customers, and also know that you have the money to put it out there.
Right.
If they are interested.
Yeah, I suppose when you back a campaign on Kickstarter, you feel like you are one of only a few that are supporting something, and you're the only one that's going to be getting the end product. But when in fact, something like Lightstep from Dark Horse, which was on Kickstarter and fully backed, is now being published by Dark Horse and everyone's enjoying it. But I mean, it's also a way for creators to get their name out there too, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it's great exposure for unknown creators. Have you guys ever backed a comic on Kickstarter?
I have, yeah.
I have not backed a comic. I've backed a number of tabletop RPGs.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's funny. Like I've normally found that it's the smaller groups who are trying to get Kickstarters funded. They normally deliver on their promises faster than like the bigger companies do. I don't know why, but that's been my experience, which I think is awesome. Not awesome. I think it's like ironic and funny. But yes, Kickstarter's a good spot to find like hidden gem comics and hidden gem creators.
We'll see if it increases over 2019.
I hope that it does. Yeah.
Second up in our news is Venom news. So if you're a Venom fan, you might be interested in this. And Ted Bundy news. So if you're a Ted Bundy fan, I'm sure you'll be very interested in this.
It's been a real good week for Ted Bundy fans, let me tell you.
Yeah, because there's a new Netflix movie. Is it a movie? It's a movie, right? With Zac
There's
Efron.
A documentary series and a movie coming out. Yeah, they have the same executive producer.
So apparently people were shipping for Ted Bundy back in the day in 79-ish, right? When the trial was televised.
Oh, I believe people still are.
And they still are today, yeah.
Way back when Ted Bundy defended himself in court was kind of the first time that he was televised, you know, got a kind of avenue to present himself to the public. You know, people had definitely heard about him by the time that his court trial was televised. He definitely got what he wanted out of it. He put on fancy bow ties, he played to the audience, he got multiple witnesses to describe the things that he did in detail, which is totally out of the norm for court proceedings, and all sorts of stuff that was just totally out of the norm for any sort of... I mean, he's a monster. I don't know how to talk about this without saying that. And so...
Yeah, but he's a really good-looking monster.
Some people definitely thought that. Yeah.
I don't know if I agree with that. He looked kind of ordinary to me.
He's got an inchworm unibrow. But at the time, he was televised, and a lot of people were like, I totally get it. I see that he's approachable. I see that he's affable. I see that he presents himself well. And he got a little bit of a fandom, even at the time, that continued forward to today. It's kind of being revisited with this new documentary series that's available on Netflix now. I think it's called The Confession Tapes of Ted Bundy or something like that. And then also the new movie starring Zac Efron. There's been some backlash to people shipping themselves with Ted Bundy or really serial killers in general, to which their defense has been, it's no different than you guys wanting to fuck Venom.
Right, right, right. Because lately people are shipping Venom thanks to the movie. And yeah, there's now this cross-pollination of Ted Bundy shipping people and Venom shipping people. What is the argument, though, that I think actually Donny Cates, the writer of Venom, was pulled into?
I think it's like, who's weirder? That's like really the argument, right? It's like, it seems to be like they're pointing the finger back at us like, well, at least I don't want to fuck a symbiote. And then the Venom people are like, yeah, well, at least I don't want to fuck a real serial killer. And it's like, yo, hey, we're all a little weird.
Yeah.
And you guys are definitely weird, and that's fine. No need to fight. Be happy and share your weirdness with one another.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, it's such a off-base argument. Cletus Cassidy is the serial killer, y'all. Point the fingers at the carnage fuckers.
Are there such a thing?
Fuckers? Yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Really? Oh, crazy. I didn't know that.
I've been on the Tumblr.
I thought it was just Venom. I didn't realize Cletus was in on this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because Cletus is where the Ted Bundy fans and the Venom fans can unite, you know, like that meme
with
the white hand, the black hand, and it's like Venom stands, Ted Bundy stands, and in the middle it says it's Carnage stands.
He's the missing link.
How long before someone takes footage from Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, the movie with Zac Efron, and then just digitally puts a symbiote on Zac Efron in the movie?
Yeah, you like that, Venom people? You like that?
10 minutes from this episode going live.
So I have a question for you guys. How long do you think before people forget all about this and it's not a big deal anymore?
I
serial killer fandom will never go away.
That's true.
But the beef between the Venom folks and the Ted Bundy folks?
Right.
I think that's going to be gone by Monday at 3:52 p.m. Pacific. Okay.
All right.
Exactly.
Set your watches, that. Folks. Set your watches.
It is definitely an interesting thing for me, though. It's just, I watched that Netflix documentary mostly because my fiance was watching it, and I couldn't get away from the idea that we're just giving him exactly what he wanted at the time.
Right.
And I don't feel that way about engaging with Venom stuff at all.
Yeah, it's the same with, like, Charles Manson, right? I mean...
Right.
Plus, I really don't like how, like, that Zac Efron movie, I watched the trailer, and after watching it, I was like, it seems like they're trying to make him seem like he wasn't that bad of a guy.
Yeah, there's absolutely no...
so uncomfortable. It's like he's one of, like, the most famous serial killers ever. He's a horrible person. I don't want to connect Zac Efron with him. I like Zac Efron, but after this movie, I'm not so sure.
There's absolutely no credence given to the victims.
That's awful.
Or, you know, he murdered at least 30 women, brutally so. Most serial killers are men who hate women, and we can't avoid that at all. Mm-hmm. Venom hates crime.
And fire.
and loud noises. Venom is one of the monsters from A Quiet Place.
All right, let's move on to the last bit of news that we have this week, which is free comic book day reveals. DC and Marvel have come out and given us a little taste of what's going to be coming out May 4th on free comic book day. With Marvel, there is an Avengers book with two stories, one by Jason Aaron and Stefano Caselli, and another story by Jerry Dugan and Mike Diodato Jr. Both obviously deal with the Avengers. And then DC has... they're sort of pushing their young adult and DC Zoom lines of series. One's for middle grade students, DC Zoom, and then the young adult is DC Inc. There's two. There's actually one that's actually kind of sounds interesting. It's called Dear Justice League Free Comic Book Day Special Edition, which is the mail the Justice League gets from kids. And then the other is a Selina Kyle story. Oh, I know, it's so cute.
It's so cute. This is Sandy from the fourth grade. She has questions about your eyes, Superman.
Why? Are they always red?
How do you stop the lasers from coming out? Signed, Sandy. P.S. I loved you in X-Men 2. Get it? Because she thinks he's Cyclops. Cyclops week.
Oh my God.
Never forget.
Never forget. 2 weeks ago. The other is a Selina Kyle story where she's homeless and 15 years old. You guys excited for these books?
Wow, that Selina Kyle one sounds like an older X-23 story.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just excited for Free Comic Book Day. I always feel like
it's
a good time.
Absolutely.
It's a fun day. You know, sometimes the stories are great, sometimes they're not. But, you know, I remember when Secret Empire was coming out, they did the Free Comic Book Day issue of Secret Empire. And it was actually, like, a huge issue. You kind of don't get the full Secret Empire story if you don't read it. I feel like the companies do actually take it seriously and they release some really good stories. So I think it's a good idea for DC to take advantage of Free Comic Book Day to try to get the DC Inc. and DC Zoom stuff off the ground. Because I do see whenever I go to the Free Comic Book Day events, it's a lot of families and kids. So I think it's like the perfect place to really push that.
Forrest, what do you think? Are you excited for these?
Yeah, I think it's a great time. You know, I think every time, to your point, Connor, every time that I go in there on Free Comic Book Day, I absolutely love it. I also think, at least in the Avengers instance, what they're so, so great at is the last page is going to be an absolute banger of a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is going to set up, if not at least the coming arc, like a whole year's worth of storytelling for Marvel. And they just commit to that. Last year, they did Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing Captain America.
Oh, yeah.
They announced that at the end of the Free Comic Book Day issue last year. And that blew my mind.
Right. And if you listen to last episode for last week, Connor went really deep into why that series is so good.
Yep. And I was right. Captain America 7 was fantastic. Just want to throw it out there.
Spoilers.
Not that we're keeping score, but, you know, pretty good last week.
I find it fascinating that some publishers, they sort of use Free Comic Book Day to give you a taste, whereas others are treating it like any other comic book day, a new comic book day, where they're delivering a big-time story. Moving on to our next segment, where we talk about our top books from last week. We're going to give our top two of last week and our two favorite comics from last week. And as always, we bring in comicbookroundup.com's highest scoring books. And at number two, Justice League Annual number 1 came in at 8.9, which probably shouldn't surprise anyone. It's a powerhouse group of creators working on this book, and I think it's even on some of our lists, of our own lists.
It sure is, let me tell you.
One thing for this one, it had a ton of reviews.
Did it? How many?
Well, at least In terms of fan reviews, which normally I don't see a ton of fan reviews mm-hmm. on books on Comic Book Roundup, mm-hmm. it had upwards of 152 fan reviews.
Wow.
And they were all high.
Wow. That's great. And
then in terms of comic book reviewers, I think when I last checked, it had at least 16.
Well, that's high. Yeah, that's definitely high. Just for some context, a typical book that's popular will get 10 maybe. And if it's a number one, it'll get like 20, but only if it's really popular. Connor, what is your second pick of the week?
Mine is Heroes in Crisis number 5, written by Tom King with art by Clay Mann. Our very own Ritesh Babu wrote a fantastic review for AIPTComics.com that really dives into what makes this issue so special. It's got this amazing speech from Superman that takes place throughout the book, and it's an incredible speech that he basically talks about how, you know, getting help is not a weakness, that we all need help from time to time, and I'm giving you the TLDR of it, but he goes on this very empowering speech that says a lot about PTSD and mental health issues, about how it's okay to seek help and all this stuff, and it was just fantastically written. I think Tom King is best when he's not doing like an action story. I think he's best in the calmer moments when it's just the heroes conversing, and a lot of that is what happens in Heroes in Crisis number 5. But it's just it's just a fantastic, fantastic issue in this series, which I've enjoyed a lot. It's very, very good. You got to check it out. Just for Superman's speech alone, it's worth reading.
I know that Tom King tweeted out that Heroes in Crisis number 5, this issue, was going to have a preview or a little hint at who was going to be Tom King's next like experimental mini series story. Previously, he'd done the Vision and Mr. Miracle to like amazing critical acclaim. Do you have a sense of who that might be after this, Connor?
No, but that's only because he said on Twitter, somebody asked him like, "Hey, did anybody figure it out yet?" And he was like, "Nope." And there were a few that kind of seemed obvious, like there's a shot of Mr. Terrific that I was like, oh, it must be Mr. Terrific, but he shot that down. And there's so many characters included in this that it's hard to make a guess. Maybe he's just doing a Superman. Like the obvious guess would be, oh, Superman is a huge part of this issue. Maybe it's just a Superman story. But I feel like that's too obvious. And they're not going to take they're not going to take Superman away from Bendis. So I don't know. I mean, either way, I'm excited to see what he does next. I'm going to be picking up that Mr. Miracle hardcover as soon as I can. So I'm looking forward to
that. Vision hardcover is gorgeous.
Forrest, what is your, wait a minute, my show notes say third pick?
He's cheating.
Yeah, I'm cheating. I'm cheating. I'm going to do a real, real quick shout out here to Shanghai Red, the trade paperback that came out from Christopher Sabella and Joshua Hickson this week. It collects all 5 issues of their Shanghai Red series from Image. I put up a review on AIPTComics.com. I gave it a 9 out of 10. It is absolutely bloody beautiful, and I mean that in both senses of the word. It is a brutal story of a woman trying to get off of a boat after being shanghaied, meaning that she was tricked into servitude on a boat, basically shackled and put onto a boat. And subsequently, she murders everyone that works on that boat and then goes back to where she was shanghaied and subsequently murders everyone that works there. But it is so much deeper than a kind of John Wickian revenge story. And there's a lot of really, really good character development, a lot of really cool art, and a lot of really cool storytelling tied into like how the colors are used and stuff. I can't speak highly enough of it. I really loved it. There's some weird things going on with slipping a little bit too frequently back into flashbacks. But aside from that, I really loved it. Check out my review if you're curious at all, but otherwise just go pick it up.
John Wickian story about a woman getting off. Awesome. Really interested.
Yep.
Forrest, what's your second pick?
My second pick is Age of X-Men Alpha number 1, written by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler with art by Ramon Rosanas. Dave, I know you read this as well. We kind of talked about it in Slack. I found this issue as frustrating as I found it.
I knew it. I said that. I called it.
Yeah. I found it as frustrating as I found it fascinating. There's a lot going on here, especially a lot to bite off and chew after the events of Uncanny X-Men Disassembled. But there is so much to set up for the coming X-Men, Age of X-Men miniseries that I think that these guys had a ton of work to do. Those are six miniseries going on until July. That the faults, I don't think you can weigh them too heavily against what succeeds here. And what succeeds is so, so much more fascinating than those frustrating bits. There's an element here that really reminds me, it's basically like self-insert fan fiction, but for Nate Gray. It's almost like he just really wants to be an X-Man. Or he is X-Man, but he wants to be an X-Men. And he's kind of inserted himself into this world where everyone is a mutant. Everyone is equal. But they still struggle with things that mutants would struggle with. It's not perfect. It's just close to perfect. And what does a world look like where everything appears to be perfect, but there are still small cracks? And what happens when the people closest to him start to recognize those cracks? Also start to trace those fault lines back to him. I found it really, really well done. It has small cliff notes that say, go follow this miniseries if you want to know what's happening here. I thought that that was a great way to do it instead of saying, devoting two pages to each miniseries, kind of, which I thought would have been unwieldy. The art is great. It's like a 70s limited color, very retro, We Can Do It poster style that I liked a lot. And everything really, really worked for me in the end, despite all the mystery that I found slightly limited, slightly frustrating. But I'm definitely on board for it, especially after the cliffhanger, which is directly tied to the Apocalypse and the Extract story, which is about Apocalypse being a 70s beatnik who is dedicated to bringing love back to the world.
Plot twist.
Yeah, I think that's a great... I love when they lean into weird stuff like that, and they really, really lean into experimenting with the world in that way. So I'm really, at the very least, going to read that one.
I haven't been reading Uncanny X-Men at all, and I found it pretty easy to get into this story and get interested in where it's going from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a great jumping on point, to be honest.
Yeah, it doesn't really touch on Uncanny X-Men at all, which I thought was a little frustrating.
I think so too.
Like, did they all go into Nate Gray's mindscape, whatever? But I feel like we're gonna find that out over coming issues.
So I'm gonna give my second pick. You guys want to know my second pick?
Yes, because
I can't wait.
I'm definitely not looking at it right now.
Mine was Justice League Annual number 1, which I also reviewed for aptcomics.com. You can see my full score and review there. It's just a huge story. I think they really pulled off a lot of different plot threads coming together all at once so that we can go somewhere new. And it has been this like brooding both for months, be it through DC Metal storyline or Justice No Justice, that four-part event, and what's been going on in Justice League in general lately. So I just want to give a shout out though to Daniel Semper, who drew the art, and I could not believe how good it was. Like, epic. It just matched how good Jim Cheung has been. They're just doing this whole like huge epic kind of Kirby-esque art that's just in your face and really exciting. And that issue, I think it pulled off a lot. I did have some reservations with it, which I say in my review, because a lot of the Justice League are sort of side characters that are kind of witnessing what's going on, whereas two or three other characters like Martian Manhunter and Hawkgirl are really the ones pulling off the main story and being the main heroes of that story. But overall, it's just cool to see DC and these big publishers pull off these big kind of epic events. Okay, so that's my second pick. So the number one pick from according to comicbookroundup.com, it was Hexwives number 4 with a 9.2, a high score. And our very own Nate Muir at aaptcomics.com has reviewed every issue, and he's really, really liked it. I've only dabbled in Hexwives. I couldn't super get into the first issue, but I can see why people are getting into it. There's like a Stepford Wives with Witches thing going on, which is pretty cool.
Oh, rad. I didn't know that that was the hook at all. That actually sounds really cool. I think the cover art is amazing.
Yeah, and the art in general, Mirka Andolfo, Italian artist, she does all the art inside, and she's quite good at the horror angle and the gore angle. I don't know. You guys haven't been dabbling in it, though, in the series?
No.
I've not at all. Yeah. I've been interested solely based on Nate's recommendation and the cover art, but I haven't had a chance to read it.
It's another DC Vertigo book that was one of the launching of their new lines of comics. And I think I'm going to just off the top of my head say, I think it's one of those ones that if you wait for the trade paperback, you're not going to be disappointed. So, Forrest, what's your number one pick?
My number one pick is Weird Number One from Kurt Pyers and Antonio Fuso. A couple of weeks ago, actually, I had an opportunity to interview Kurt, who is writing the story, and that's over on AIPTComics.com. This is a new series. I think it's a 4-issue miniseries from Dark Horse about a immortal, unkillable U.S. law enforcement contractor named Peter Weird, who takes on the strangest, weirdest cases that no other law enforcement agency sees fit to solve for a fee. Kurt does a really great job of making the story evocative but minimalistic. You have a sense that everyone aside from Weird has a better idea of what's going on than him. And they're simply not telling him the full scale of what's happening. But he kind of gets sent to this weird Russian farmscape. And he gets put up against a Hulk-like character. And it's literally, it looks like the Hulk. And he has to fight it to the death. And basically just, the Hulk is like, I'm going to fucking kill you, blah, 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 blah. And Peter is like, I can't die at all, so good luck. I can't die. And the Hulk just keeps trying. And then finally, Peter shoots his head off and is like, I told you. I don't know what you expected to come of this. It's got a really great kind of like Hunter S. Thompson dark energy to it. There's a really dark comedy to scenes like that where characters are just so set on doing something, but there's a grand cosmic humor to the fact that we know, as well as some of the characters know, that things simply can't play out that way. There's an irony and almost like a sadism to it. And the way that it plays just slightly parallel to the real world makes it feel like the bigger than life aspects of it are blown up in a way that we can take small aspects of it and apply them to our own real life. And especially so in that eventually we see that Peter is really thinking the whole time about what I'm presuming to be a long lost love of his. So I'm definitely hooked. I'm a little bit bummed that it's only going to be 4 issues, but Antonio and Kurt are doing a really, really great job of tying together a lot of disparate elements into something that feels so close to our world, but also just so out of step with it that it feels digestible and abstract in a great way.
Awesome. Put that on the back of the book when it comes out in collected format. The whole thing, what you just said.
Yeah, it's going to be a very large trade paperback, but they'll fit the whole quote on.
Can they print an MP3 and put it on there?
Oh, you're right. Oh, it'll be like those cards, you open it and it, like, you know how it plays music? It'll just play your voice. This person really knows what he's talking about. I'm buying this. Connor, what's your number one pick?
I echo your second pick. I chose Justice League Annual number one. my God, this book, it has the size and scope and the impact of a major event squeezed into a 40-page annual, and it's awesome. When I was reading it, I couldn't believe it because I was like, there's so much happening, and this is so huge and massive. Like, I can't believe this is just an annual. Like, it just makes me happy for what they must have planned if they're putting something this big into an annual issue. It's so exciting. It's a huge book for the DC universe. It builds on, like Dave said, it builds on something Scott Snyder's been working on since Metal. And it's so awesomely executed, and there's so much payoff. And it it ends with like a very oh shit moment for the DC universe that I will try not to give away, but it's we just know that the DC universe is in a fuck ton of trouble moving forward, and this issue just did an incredible job setting things up and simultaneously setting things up and being very entertaining at the same time. I couldn't believe it. It's fucking awesome. It was such a good issue. I Justice League was a book that I wasn't that excited about because I'm not a big team up comic book story fan, and now Justice League is like one of my favorite releases every month. It has been so good. I cannot wait to see where the story goes from here.
I really love seeing something like that pay off for both fans and the writers. I can't imagine the amount of happiness and joy that a writer gets in knowing that something that they've probably been keeping secret for so long is finally in readers' hands.
And it's just, it's so, so big in scope, and it's being executed so well, where it's, even though it's so big in scope, it's not hard to understand. It's very approachable. It has been so unbelievably good.
You make a good point. It could probably have been, what happens in this annual probably could have been over the course of 3 or 4 issues. They could have told the same story, but stretched it out, but they didn't.
Yeah, they just gave it to the readers all at once, and it was exciting. It was memorable. It had plenty of emotion to it. It's just so unbelievably good.
So my number one pick is Journey into Unknown Worlds number one, written by Cullen Bunn and Clay Chapman. They each wrote their own story. One is Cullen Bunn wrote the first story, and Chapman wrote the second story, with artists Guillermo Sanabaza and Francesco Mana. This is my favorite book of the week because it's so accessible to self-contained beginning, middle, and end stories about, and they're both horror stories. And they kind of, they romanticize, I don't know if romanticize is the right word, they steer into the weird, strange, old school kind of comics, which is what this series is about, right? They're bringing back all these number ones. And Marvel is sort of honoring their history by bringing these series back. And I think they're all just one-off stories, which is cool because not only can you celebrate Marvel, but enjoy a little original storytelling at the same time. Both stories are creepy in their own ways. One's sort of like a Boy Scouts around the campfire telling scary stories, and the other is astronauts find something, and it's way worse than they could have imagined. Both are really well written, and both have that kind of grungy, dirty, indie art style that suits the horror aspects of each story. Did you guys read this book at all?
I did not.
It's in my stack. I'm actually really happy with these Marvel 80-year anniversary one-off stories they're doing, because for the most part, they've all been very good. And when I saw Cullen Bunn was attached to this, that I was like, all right, I got to pick it up. I got to read it.
Yeah, he does a great job.
Cullen should never not write horror, as far as I'm concerned. Harrow County is one of my favorite horror comics of all time.
Also, I want to point out, I believe we are now 6 for 6 on bringing up Cullen Bunn at some point during our podcast. So, Cullen Bunn, we'd love to have you on, because apparently we're your biggest fans.
The official comic books writer of the AIPT Comics podcast.
We should just come up with a drinking game, the AIPT Comics podcast drinking game, where if someone brings up the Wildstorm, drink twice. Someone brings up Cullen Bunn, drink 3 times. Moving on, we haven't done this segment in a while, a couple weeks now. It's called Trending Now, where we talk about what we think is trending right now in comic books. And I don't even think we think this. This is fact. There are a lot of series now that are written by multiple writers, which is interesting for a variety of reasons, one of which being, how do they split up the work? Does one guy write page 2 and one woman write page 4? And like, how does that work? There are series like Uncanny X-Men, which I believe, the first 8 issues were written by 3 writers?
10.
Ten issues.
Yeah.
Matthew Rosenberg, Kelly Thompson, and Ed Brisson. And then we've got Avengers No Surrender last year, which was written by
Mark Waid, Al Ewing, and Jim Zub. And they're also doing the sequel, which comes out this year, No Road Home.
Yeah, exactly. And Charles Soule and Scott Snyder are working on a book together right now. And then even in Justice League, every single issue is story by Scott Snyder and James Tynion. So in some way, shape, or form, they're also collaborating on that book. And then there was The Signal by Scott Snyder and Tony Patrick, I believe last year, which was also two writers.
Justice League No Justice was Scott Snyder, James Tynion, and Josh Williamson. It was the three of them. So yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where this is legitimately a trend now. Like, it's everywhere. There are team-up books in the way that it's a team-up of heroes, but it's also a literal team-up book because writers are teaming up to tell a story. It's great.
It's great sometimes, I would say.
It doesn't always work. And that's interesting, too, because everyone talks about, like, the writing process. And for most folks, it's this, you know, time where you're alone and you're in the attic and you're just typing away and then you're done. It's not as collaborative unless you're talking about, like, TV or movies.
Yeah, I mean, there are some instances where I know a writer and an artist will work really, really closely together, and you might as well just give them both a writing credit. I think the industry is weird in that way, and I'm going to say that when I interviewed Kurt Pyers about his book Weird, he said that he and Antonio Fuso actually just asked to be called co-creators, not writer and artist.
Right.
So that's interesting, and I think that that's an important part of the creative process. You'll find the same thing with Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman, where they say for Venom, they just talk on the phone for hours and hours at a time, plotting things and figuring out the visual language as well as the narrative language of a book. But in this instance, specifically when a lot of creators are listed as the writer, I'm curious about how they divide up the work there and how they divide up who's taking main story beats, who's taking dialogue, who's taking the breakdown of the panels on each page. There's a lot of resources online, by the way, where you can go and find an individual creator's script for an issue. Colin Bunn's first issue of the Sixth Gun script is out there. Drink, by the way. Kelly Pseudoconics, it's some of her issues of Captain Marvel and Bitch Planet are out there. Matt Fraction is out there. So you can see kind of how they do it, and you can see how they do it so independently. But I have no idea what that process would look like with other people in the room or other people in the document.
You make a good point. It could be a case where they weren't actively trying to work together, but because they had meetings and were calling each other, they just have to give each other credit because someone came up with one of the most important plot points or whatever.
I always wonder, too, with something like Uncanny X-Men, as I was reading it, I was thinking, like, okay, so did they just, like, break up the dialogue? Like, Rosenberg gets to write the characters he's been writing, so he does the Jamie Madrox, and he did Jean Grey, and he did the New Mutants, and then Ed Brisson gets to write, he gets to write the Cyclops Glob. And Glob and all that, and then Kelly Thompson takes... I don't know, It's really hard to comment on the actual process of it all because we don't know how it all shakes out. We can just comment on the final products, and I think for the most part, most of these group written books have been solid. I think occasionally you can have like some clashing styles, but for the most part, they've been very enjoyable.
Personally, I think it does... The comic industry suffers ever so slightly because I feel like we get less stories from the creators when they're all working together on these things. Like, if only Kelly Thompson was writing Uncanny X-Men, would Matthew Rosenberg have put out two or three other books at the same time, and Ed Brisson too? Or are they continuing to output as many stories as they were regardless?
Oh, no, I feel like with that specific example, like, Ed Brisson's still... He's still writing a bunch outside of Uncanny X-Men. I mean, he's doing Dead Man Logan and shit, maybe that's it.
X-Force.
Thank you, X-Force. I know he's doing something else. And then like Matt Rosenberg, he's doing a ton. You know, he's doing The Punisher and he has a few Image series in the works, so I think they're still doing stuff. But yeah, it does make you wonder like what else they could be doing if they weren't helping out with this book.
Like, for instance, Scott Snyder, I think obviously he's been talking lately about how he's doing more creative own work this year. And maybe he can because, you know, James Tynion IV is actually writing a lot of the scripts, even though Snyder is credited as a story writer.
Yeah, it's possible, you know. I will say that I have no hesitancy about Charles Soule's and Scott Snyder's upcoming creator-owned book. Scott has really carved out a really great niche as being a collaborative writer with Justice League and The Signal and a lot of the other projects that he's worked on. Obviously, we don't know what the total breakdown there is, but everything that he has two names on in terms of writerdom has been really great. Uncanny X-Men, on the other side, did not totally work for me. It was really obvious that they were all trying to use that book as a launching off point for stories they wanted to tell right. in the broader X-verse. And it ended up serving too many narratives and too many masters and too many disparate voices. To your point, Connor, I could really tell what writers were writing specific characters. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to see that Matt is taking on Uncanny X-Men after this. I'm happy to see that the series is continuing. But here at the end of Disassembled, after issue 10, in hindsight, I don't think it worked for me. I pretty much only see it as a jumping off point for individual stories.
So it goes to show you, like, everyone, it's a ship that either sinks or sails. All the writers, if it is a collaborative book, like if No Surrender was a complete failure, all three writers are kind of on the hook for that, right?
Yeah, but it...
Absolutely. I think...
It would take more than one bad book to take Mark Waid down.
True. Yeah,
you know, if we look ahead and think about this in a different light, this is a possibly a great way for Marvel or DC or whoever, Image Comics, to sell a series that may not be as, maybe it's an original series, maybe it's an unknown superhero, whatever. But if you slap Grant Morrison, Mark Waid, and Al Ewing on a book and go, this is the new series, I mean, you're going to start to pull in all of their fans, right? So it's a good way to sort of pump up the volume. Pump it up, pump it up.
I was waiting to see if somebody was going to do that.
So from a marketing standpoint, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same idea as super bands, right?
And one could argue, like, the signal, maybe the reason Scott Snyder was on it at all was because Tony Patrick doesn't necessarily have that social media pull that Snyder does. And for all we know, maybe Snyder wasn't as involved in it as one might think.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that Marvel has the Young Guns series. You know, they get this roster of artists and writers that they say, hey, basically, these are the people that we are keeping an eye on. These are the people that we're going to be putting on series. These are the people that we think in a year or 2 years are going to be our mainstays. These are going to be the people that we want to tell the stories that we want to tell looking down the timeline for Marvel. I think it's an interesting prospect or an opportunity to just attach them to the writers that they have right now.
We'll see if there's more of these kind of stories come out where there's multiple writers on a single series in 2019. Moving on, we're going to be talking about our favorite or our most anticipated book of next week, the top book for next week. And this is what we're looking forward to, we think is going to be good, or we already know maybe. And... Why? So, Connor, I want you to start because you have an interesting pick.
I chose Daredevil number one, written by Chip Zdarsky and drawn by Marco Cicchetto.
Woo!
Charles Soule did a fantastic job with his Daredevil run throughout, but he also did a great job ending it. Charles Soule made the joke when he ended it that it's a rite of passage for Daredevil writers to leave Matt Murdock in the absolute worst position possible to make the next writer's job a pain in the ass. And that's exactly what he did for Chip Zdarsky. But I love Chip Zdarsky. The weird thing is, though, what I like the most about Chip Zdarsky and the stuff I've read from him is he's super funny and he has a great sense of humor. And that's very obvious on his Twitter, too. He's a very, very funny guy. So I'm extremely interested to see how he writes Matt Murdock. Because Matt Murdock is not a funny character. And he doesn't quip. He doesn't do any of that. He's very stern and serious. So I don't even know if excited is the right word. I'm very, very intrigued and interested to see how Chip Zdarsky does it. On the art side of things, Marco Cicchetto is awesome. We were just talking about, he's one of Marvel's young guns, I believe. He was in one of their classes, and he's incredible. He did Old Man Hawkeye, and the art in Old Man Hawkeye was part of what made Old Man Hawkeye so good. So I don't know. It's a pretty awesome creative team. Daredevil is in a very tricky spot. We'll see how Man Without Fear wraps up. I haven't read that yet, but I know Man Without Fear just wrapped up. So I'm very, very excited to see what Chip Zdarsky can do and where this series goes.
He's pulling a Robin Williams. The man was funny for all this time, and now what is he doing? He's doing deep, deep cut drama.
He's doing a spectacular Spidey number 310. That should make me cry. That wasn't funny at all. You made me cry spider tears.
That's true. We should not doubt Sadarsky. He's going to pull it off.
Yeah. I think, who was somebody tweeted out that saying, like, after people read Daredevil number one, they're going to realize Chip Zdarsky is one of the all-time best superhero comic book writers. And that's some heavy praise. So
that's high praise.
I'm very excited. Very excited to see what it looks like.
Forrest, what's your number one book you're looking forward to next week?
Conan number 3, written by Jason Aaron with art by Mahmoud Asrar. I think I said, a quick aside, actually, I was going to pick Uncanny X-Men number 11. And the reason that I did not is that the artist attached to that book is Salvador LaRocca. Salvador LaRocca sent out a post with his art where he said, I would like to post this art without the colors because my editor sent out a post with the colors attached, and I like my art so much more without the colors because the colors were bad. It's amazing that Marvel has so many bad colorists.
Jesus.
In this case, it was a woman.
The most unnecessary jab at a woman ever.
Yeah, not really necessary to say that, dude.
Like, it was all bad anyway, and then, like, just to really send it over the top of being an asshole, it's like, why did you have to just... It's not even said, like, of course a woman did this. He just said, like, oh, and she was a woman. Like, what the fuck?
It's like he was trying to rally troops around his hate, his anger.
Yeah.
So weird. Unprofessional to the max.
It's an interesting play. It's the reason that I did not pick Uncanny X-Men number 11. I'm still going to read it. I hope that Matt Rosenberg does some work to divorce Salvador LaRocca from the book as quickly as he can. But in his stead, I have picked Conan number 3. Conan is a great story. I'm really interested in the way that Aaron is tying the larger plot, the larger threat to Conan, into these smaller episodic stories. And in a world where you have blood magic and giant snakes and a kind of ongoing struggle with civilization and the barbarism that Conan engages with, it's an interesting time to be reading a story like that, I think. And Aaron is really leaning into that and kind of leaning into a larger social justice angle that hasn't really been explored in Conan before. And I'm really excited for it. Asrar's art being attached to that is just a cherry on top.
Yeah, he's doing the best work of his career right now.
Absolutely.
Great pick. I'm probably going to also highly enjoy that book when it comes out. My pick for next week, though, is an X-Men book. Age of X-Men, Marvelous X-Men number 1, which is a 5-part miniseries by Lonnie Nadler, Zach Thompson, and art by Marco Falla. So obviously, I really, really liked the one-shot last week. Is it a one-shot? The special.
It is.
And
yeah, there will be an Omega issue at the end of all these miniseries.
Get it? Well, like Alpha and Omega? Get it?
I do get it.
It's biblical.
While that issue was a really good jumping on point for all these other series, it was also a really good jumping on point for this series, which is almost... I actually was looking on the message boards, people talking about the preview that we had an exclusive of on AAPTComics.com for this issue, The Marvelous X-Men. A lot of people were talking about how they were getting a Justice League vibe from this team, and I not necessarily have a Justice League vibe from it, but I do have like a super team, like the Avengers or something, and it's kind of neat. Because it does feel a little different than the usual X-Men shtick. It's more like a super team of mutants rather than the X-Men mutants and their typical sort of familial, you know, dynamic that they're a family. So I'm really excited for this. I'm curious to see where it goes. And Nadler and Thompson have just been killing it for over a year. They were my pick for the best up-and-coming creators of 2018. Even if they have been around for a little while, I still wanted to give them a shout out there because their run on Cable was just excellent. And I'm not even that big of a Cable fan. If they can make me a believer in Cable, they can make me a believer in Marvelous X-Men.
Yeah, the only problem I have with it is the X-23 look. So
she does. She has a funny look.
She looks like frumpy. She has a mohawk. She looks like a frumpy Arya Stark. I don't like it, but that's a personal issue. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
All right, guys, moving on. We're going to be talking about the cover, our favorite cover of a comic book coming out next week called Judging by the Cover. We also have a weekly column at aptcomics.com called Judging by the Cover. And this is our chance to pick one cover that we really, really liked. And it's also a way for us to kind of honor the artists out there because, you know, 9 times out of 10, we're all talking about writing, but not necessarily the art. My pick was for Daredevil number 1 by Jamal Campbell. he is fantastic artist. He doesn't do too much. He does a lot of interiors, not just covers, but this cover is out of this world. The use of blur is really, really cool. Daredevil is jumping through a round window with glass shattering all around him, and he's got this cool pose where it's like almost like he's doing a spell like Doctor Strange, while his baton is flying right at us. And the use of the moon for lighting on his shoulders and arm and head are really, really cool. It gives you that intensity that you would want from a character like Daredevil, who's a vigilante busting skulls in alleyways. So that's my pick. Connor, what's your pick?
So my pick is, I don't know, it's kind of cheating, but it's fine. It is Batman number 428, cover C, Ace Entertainment, exclusive by Mike Mignola. Is that pronounced right? Mignola?
Mignola.
Mignola. So this is the famous Death in the Family cover that features a bloodied Jason Todd. This is now 2 weeks in a row I get to talk about a Jason Todd cover, so that makes me happy.
Drink. Drink three times.
Drink there. There it is. Anyway, it's like I don't even need to make a Wildstorm reference while I'm making Jason Todd references, and look at that. Two weekly references in one sentence. Proud of myself.
Drink.
Anywho, it's a rad cover. It's an iconic cover from an iconic Batman story. I had to highlight it. I mean, it's $30, which is a little pricey.
Wow.
For a cover. But, I mean, if you're a big Jason Todd fan like I am, $30 ain't too shabby. So it's just really cool to see this cover get some love again, and I think it's very rad. So, yeah, that's mine.
Nice. Forrest?
My pick is Tony Stark, Iron Man, number 8, by Alexander Lozano. We have been making a lot of jokes about drinking in this episode. Tony Stark has actually struggled quite a bit with alcoholism throughout his character development, and I think it's a really interesting choice for the character. It's something that they haven't talked about or visited a lot in his most recent stories. It's certainly not something that they visited in the movies at all, and I understand why. But this cover depicts Tony in the Iron Man suit being crushed amongst ice cubes in a tumbler. And the kind of preview for the issue says that drink that you're drinking isn't real, Tony. And there's kind of a hint that he may be trapped in some sort of simulation that is picking on all of his worst vices or the things that he's trying to break away from, one of them being alcoholism, which is something that people struggle with for all their lives. You know, if you're an alcoholic, even if you haven't had a drink for years, decades, you're an alcoholic for your entire life. And Tony is no different, no different than maybe Hank Pym, who hasn't been as rehabilitated as Tony Stark's reputation has. And to see a cover that just dares to go there in that way, as well as a story that I think is going to, I was really excited to see it the way that it is done in this kind of painterly style. It feels shocking. It feels, well, stark. And it feels respectable of the struggles that these people go through, and humanizing in a way that people can see themselves and see their own struggles in a superhero character and know that they're going to explore a tough topic, but do it in a way that maybe needs to be done. And again, in a bigger than life way, so that you can take a little bit of it into your own personal life and get something out of it. And seeing the way that Lozano has depicted that bigger than life struggle is really well done, and I liked it quite a bit.
I want to know if Lozano took an Iron Man action figure and put it in a tumbler with ice.
It does look like that. Yeah,
it's very realistic. The ice looks really, really good, really realistic. And I like how there's like bubbles coming out of his mouth, because you can kind of tell he's like drowning in the drink.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. So guys, every show ends the same way, but a little bit differently, because we do our weekly soapbox and there's different topics every time where we get passionate and we share our thoughts on something. Sometimes we're angry, sometimes we're happy. And today, Forrest gets a chance to get on that soapbox and tell us something about the comic book industry that he's passionate about.
Yeah. So this week we're happy. last week I was mad at Bill Maher. I was mad about that for like the rest of the day, by the way. I didn't think a take on that, and then I was just like fuming about it.
you were mad online. You were mad online about it.
Yeah, I just added the universe. I want to talk about the simple joy of seeing artists do what they love on social media, which is something that I don't think we appreciate enough. I don't want to talk about how we don't appreciate it enough. I just want to say that we have such an incredible opportunity, and I love it so much when I see artists posting sketches or fully done pieces or things that they did for warm-up or things that they did just because they wanted to, or commissions. Or I really love seeing Spider Sonas from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I picked a couple artists out here that I really love seeing do this. Riley Rossmo, Daniel Warren Johnson, Becky Cloonan, Emily Pearson. And then there's also a big cartel shop called Revenge of the Nerds, or ROTN, on Instagram that I buy quite a few shirts from. And all of these folks consistently post art that they just so clearly love doing. And they do it because they love the craft and because they want to share it with people that love the craft as much as them. You're being invited to an artistic process that no other time in history has afforded us an insight into in this way. And it is so, so valuable and enriching to our day-to-day lives. The flip side of it is, of course, people will say your anatomy is bad or your art is dumb or I don't like Batman. Who cares about that stuff? Enrich your life with seeing the things that these people love doing. And Riley Rossmo is out there drawing Batman like a Kamen Rider character. And I love it. I live for those big dragonfly eyes that he's attaching to these characters that I love. I love seeing Daniel Warren Johnson draw Akira commissions or Venom commissions or all sorts of commissions that he loves doing in a crazy heavy metal style that he clearly loves doing because he's also writing Murder Falcon.
Which is a hell of a book if anyone hasn't read it.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome. I love seeing Becky Cloonan draw little dispatches from her ongoing Dungeons & Dragons game. She has some goblin character that she really loves. She, every time her goblin character gets like a new crown or item or weapon or whatever, she updates her like character sheet and just posts it out there because she loves doing it. It's rendered just as well as the rest of her art. Sometimes it's not, but she just wanted to do it because she has the skill set to express herself in that way. And then we have Emily Pearson, who worked on The Wilds, a really great Black Mask series, where she just posts paneling and sketches and sometimes like headshot commissions and stuff like that. But she honestly says, hey, I so sincerely want to improve my art, and I'm asking this artistic sphere of influence that I've accumulated on Twitter and Instagram and stuff for help. And just as a reviewer, but also as a person who reviews stuff because I love the craft, having an insight into that and seeing that dialogue play out is incredible. I don't think people appreciate it enough. I don't see people talk about it enough. I don't see people saying, Emily, the fact that you put yourself out there like that is amazing, and we should.
It's super cool. Like, you bring up Emily Pearson. She's absurdly nice. When I was doing the YouTube series of 5 and 5 or Pull This, whatever you remembered it as, I talked about The Wilds, and she like messaged me on Twitter and was like, hey, thank you so much for talking about the book. Like, it really makes me and Vita, and Vita's the writer, but it really, really makes Vita and I feel like really good about what we're doing, and I really appreciate and all this stuff. So it's cool to have that back and forth with these artists, especially when you enjoy their work and the fact that, like you said, they're willing to put themselves out there and possibly face people being a-holes online, but they do it anyway. I think it's very rad.
Yeah, it's easy to forget that they are kind of putting themselves out there for criticism. Even if they are like master artists, they're still showing unfinished work.
It's all in process.
Bilquis Evely is another artist that she will show her inking, and it's amazing to see her doing it all by hand on paper. I thought everybody was doing it digitally now, but now I'm like, wow, I have to appreciate your art even that much more.
Mike Diodato shows off a lot of his process too, especially on what he's doing with Superior Spider-Man, and it's fascinating to look at because it's that same thing. First of all, he does it on paper, which is crazy because it's 2019, but also how detailed everything is just, it's
bonkers.
Or Ryan Stegman too, right? We were talking about that.
Yeah, oh Ryan. God,
Stegman.
Yeah, Ryan's amazing. I just find it so, so inspiring.
It really
to
is.
To anyone with any sort of creative passion.
Thank you for your soapbox, Forrest. And, you know, if you like this show and you are as passionate about comic books as we are, and Forrest, especially Forrest, it was so passionate. I loved it. Please like this show and please subscribe, maybe even share it, and give us a quick review, too. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back here next Sunday.
Bye, Yukio.
See ya.